we're having this get together for a discussion is that during our winter program planning meeting last Friday morning, there was an interest in this subject. So we decided that we'd get together and you know, the discussion just depends on who's here and what everybody has to say. We had a forum this morning that Jim Fish gave on the Ten Commandments that was really fascinating. And you're all, can I assume that everyone here is familiar with the Ten Commandments? Yeah. The question that we were asking ourselves this morning was, are we sophisticated enough now that none of the Ten Commandments apply? And that none of the laws that concern the sexual ethics apply in this society? I could go on and talk more about what he talked about, but
he made a brief little allusion about the fact that the Israelites were a more primitive people than we are. We want to use that terminology, but locations around primitive, and locations around sophisticated, if that's what we are. And he just posed the question, have we changed enough, has culture changed enough, so that we could assume that some of these commandments wouldn't apply to us in the way that they did.
Seems like the most obvious thing on that is that when the Bible was written and at the time of Anna, it was a safeguard for the woman when the rule was no sex before marriage, because women were inferior people and they would be, what's the word, exploited by the males if that was to be allowed. But now it doesn't seem that needs to hold true anymore, because men and women are completely equal and can have mutually loving relationships where exploitation doesn't have to be an issue. So I would take that as being an answer to Dan's question about, are we still primitive people or not?
So we're changing social conditions.
How much of our social conditions really changed? I mean, there's still dishonest people around. There's still people around.
But women aren't held in the same light as they were in the writings of the first.
In some places, in America.
I guess I'm talking about England and America.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's a matter of being more primitive or not primitive, but in Gemma and I were talking a couple of days ago, and we were mentioning that it's important to look at the Bible in the context of when it was written. And in those days, if you weren't married, most likely you were already promised by your parents, you know, with the covenant that such and such and such and such would be married. And so you were already kind of committed to somebody. And so that's a point that, you know, I don't know how much.
Do you think a different kind of sexual ethic is appropriate for people not married than people who are married?
Yeah.
Because one is married, are you expected to behave differently?
Yeah, because you made a commitment to be with one person. And I think that adultery is a very real threat to that kind of social cohesion. And I think that if you haven't made a commitment to be with one person, then you are asked to use your responsibility as an adult Christian or whatever to determine, in the way that Dan was saying, in the light of the gospel, in the light of your view of love or whatever. Nothing so heavy as that. I'm not being coherent to that. I think the law about adultery should hold, and I think that a lot of it was written in the Bible that we now have as being reasons for not having sexual relations outside marriage were to do with the culture that they were written in, and that times have changed since then. And I'd just like to see that.
At what age do people marry back then?
15, 14.
Especially for women in Israel, yeah.
Yeah, so what happens now from age 13 to 30 when you're not married and people marry so much later and after puberty and all these things? What's to be with your sexuality from this time? Mm-hmm. How do you deal with that?
Along with that question, even biblically, in that time, there was more freedom allowed men than the women. It was all right for men to have relationships outside their marriage. And women couldn't or shouldn't.
That was in scripture, that was okay? Or do you just mean that people didn't?
Well, it was a more culturally accepted thing.
They had examples of if a man has relations with a female slave who's betrothed, that isn't the best kind of conduct, but all he has to do is pay a small guilt fee and then he's let off the hook. But if he has sexual relations with a woman, with a virgin who's betrothed to another man, then they were both killed. What would be better?
Are you just talking about the Old Testament?
That's an Old Testament.
That's Old Testament, yeah. There's not so much in the New about that. There's more kind of explicit. And then if a man has sexual relations with a virgin who's not betrothed, then either he must marry her, which is to protect the woman, I suppose, otherwise she couldn't ever marry again. But if the woman's father doesn't want her to marry, then the man has to pay the father the equivalent in bride price to absolve himself. But I don't see that is absolving himself before God. I see that as absolving himself in the cultural setting of that time. And so it implies that it isn't necessarily offending God, but it's offending the social relations.
One thing that I just saying a few minutes ago in the store that might apply is that we, some of us anyway, have a tendency to want to begin with an answer. In this situation here, and also Dan talked about it too, with the idea of principles, absolute principles, that when we discuss ethics particularly, and I'm one of those, if someone could give me a principle that I could hold on to, then I'd be much comforted, because I feel that there would be an absolute answer. And I'm not at all sure that comfort is coming. And then the other thing would be too that any acts that I could square with that principle, then I would be absolved of responsibility for those acts, and that's the other side. It's not only telling me what I may not do, but it also might, if with a little quick calculation in my head, I can figure out what's all right to do, or I can hire a lawyer, and the two of us can figure out what it's all right for me to do that comes within that law. And then I'm absolved from responsibility. So we want to shift the responsibility up to the other. But also it occurred to me on this thing of sexual ethics when Dan talked about not wanting to use the word marriage. I think the social framework of our acts is one we tend to forget too. I want to, when I think of having sexual relations with another person, I'd love if I could keep the framework between just me and that other person. It's so much simpler if I don't have to think of anything except the two of us. But in fact, our acts affect all the people around us. They affect all of our groups that the two of us are in. The same or different groups. And so the ramifications are wider than just the two of us. I relate differently to married couples than I do to couples who are living together as though married, but not married. Because they may have all sorts of agreements, or they may have some definitions on their relationship, but those are unknown to me. And I can't, therefore, relate to two people living together as though they're married, and I don't. I don't have the expectations of permanence. If two married people are having difficulties, I pray for them, that they'll manage to resolve those difficulties. Two people are living together and they're having difficulties, I've got nothing to do with it. Because I've got no commitment in that myself. Should I pray that they stay together? Or should I pray that they not? I don't relate the same way.
The key factor is the nature of the commitment between the two people?
The key factor is that the nature of the commitment is unknown.
I mean, if you know the commitment between two married people, then their sexual relationship is acceptable because you understand the kind of permanent commitment they've made to each other.
Yeah, I'm not limiting this to their sexual you know, relationships. I don't mean that marriage was a license for that. What I mean is that the relationship itself is a different one to me, an outsider, depending on what kind of public social acknowledgement has been made of the commitment as over and against a merely private, personal, limited mean to those two, right? There may be other areas. Maybe sometimes a public commitment is announced without merit, without going through some rite. That could be another possibility. I don't know any people like that, but there may well be.
In other words, your position is that sexual intercourse should be reserved for those who made a formal, permanent commitment.
That may be, but that's not what I'm saying.
Oh, sorry.
What I'm saying is that two people living together who wish to say that this is the equivalent, I mean, if they've got the commitment for each other, that's the equivalent of marriage. I cannot see that unless they specifically say it in such a way that I clearly can see it. And my relationship to those two people is going to be different. In other words, you exclude yourself from some things by not making a public commitment.
And presumably they've chosen to do that, so that's fine. They don't want you to look at them as married, otherwise they would be. That's great, that's fine. And about the thing about not praying for people if they have a row, say Beth and I end up hitting each other tonight. Mm-hmm. We don't want to live together, mm-hmm. but we want there not to be a breach there. Mm-hmm. I would still hope that you'd pray for us. And I guess the same for two people living together.
Why do those, see, you've said it exactly. When I look at two people living together, and they haven't made that public commitment, my thinking about their relationship is very much got that question in it. Why haven't they? Precisely that. And how am I to view their relationship?
I guess for us not to judge and just to accept them for who they are. Not that you're judging, I didn't mean that.
Not a question of
but
judging.
They're not
who are they?
They're X and Y.
We're
all
together.
Yeah.
If I could move it in this way. Another area that see how you react. It's fun to talk to couples that live together because men are married and talked about what was the difference in the quality of the relationship. Most of them, in honesty, ladies that I've talked to have said that before the marriage, there always was a kind of a knowledge in the back of the mind that this person could walk off tomorrow, and that after the marriage, especially if it was a healthy marriage, there was a sense that I can be myself any way I want because I know this person is really committed to me and in a different qualitative way. I'm just interested what you think of me. Okay. I tend to remember statements from people that I agree with.
Hasn't it become true in our culture now that even with married people, that it's almost an even chance that one of them is going to walk off tomorrow?
Yeah.
Marriage has dissolved so frequently now that they're almost as good a chance that they won't stay together.
Well, it's possible that's changing and could change. So
I'm just trying to figure out what the difference is. Maybe the difference is that the married couple, most of us go into marriage thinking that we aren't going to break up. Whereas those who choose to live together are holding that out as a distinct possibility. But many of us get surprised and even married people get surprised.
Well, and there seems to be a shift in the attitude of married people too, that they want, you know, if it doesn't work out, they can that there's a different emphasis there now than there was before.
But is there really I mean, are we talking about what's right for everybody or just right as Christians? And it seems to me that there's a difference with people who are strong in the relationship with God don't expect that now. That there hasn't been a change there. Mm-hmm. Even though, sure, it happens. But I don't know if there really is a difference there.
Well, the Bible comes down just as hard on divorce as it does on these other things. But because we're a culture that has to cope with that problem, there's a shift in attitude and expectation. How to bring it back to biblical teaching and to say you better not divorce the way it was two generations ago. Is that better than people living together unhappily for all their life? But biblically, divorce is just as...
I mean, the thing, the living together unhappily is not the only possibility. There's a possibility of trust that can resolve a relationship. There's a possibility of giving myself up to infuse a relationship with life again. It isn't simply an either-or possibility. There are other possibilities.
That's sort of alluding to what I was thinking, that it seems as though in relating that with our Christian life and our Christian lifestyle, part of, or really all of being a Christian is to give up yourself. And there's so much emphasis in our culture in self gratification or self-fulfillment or self whatever it is. It seems like if something isn't just right for me, then I must throw it away and go and look for something else which is right, rather than stressing the idea of giving up yourself for the sake of another relationship or...
Don't most couples who divorce conclude that if the marriage isn't good for either of them? And we should ask those who are pastors if that's the case.
But isn't it because each of them is looking for some kind of something to do with them, with it? They're not willing to give up the other one.
Yeah.
Neither of them is willing to give up. I mean, I agree that probably some divorces are necessary. But...
What's your question again, Dave?
The question was whether most couples who decide to divorce, whether in most cases they don't believe that it's better for both parties to divorce. That is, that it's not just simply a selfish thing that I don't like this marriage, so I'm getting out, but neither of us has any happy future in this marriage. Neither of us can be fulfilled in this marriage, and therefore we should divorce. Is that...
That, to me, still sounds like a selfish... on the part of both people. In that particular, the way you put it. So.
Yeah.
I'd like to know how somebody feels in this sense of, you know, fulfilling yourself or doing something that's good for you in as regards sex outside marriage or outside a commitment. I don't use the word marriage like Dan. Although for me that's marriage, but in what way is sex outside marriage? I mean, I just think there's an extreme emphasis in our whole culture on the self, whether it's in sex or in other things.
I've got an answer for your non-question. Dan was talking, I think, in the session about how the intimacy of the sexual relationship. And I believe you called it, correct me, Dan, if I'm wrong, but I believe you called it the most intimate, or the place where the person is most vulnerable.
Yeah, well, yeah, I use the two intimate and vulnerable.
Yeah. And I, as you said that, for the first time in my life, I questioned that. I've heard that asserted before. And for the first time in my life, I questioned that, whether that's really true or not. I think there's an immediate vulnerability, certainly. But I think it depends a good deal on what I define as myself. Where my boundaries of intimacy are. We all have read or know of, or ourselves are people who can or have had sexual relationships without intimacy. I mean, that's pretty well accepted that that can happen. So sex is not necessarily intimate. And, or again, there may be people who can have very deep intimacy that are not having a sexual relationship. But that we assert that and accept it, as I have accepted it for years, as a truism, shows how we think about this. I'm not having sexual relations with anyone right now, therefore am I not having any intimacy with people then? I mean, we do tend to, I think, accept that statement without thinking.
Virginia and Leonard Woolf would be a good exception of a married couple who did not really have the sexual intimacy, but an incredible marriage. Virginia and Leonard Woolf. I guess that what you're saying, Keith, fits the fact that in most people's lives, the sexual dynamic is very important. I wouldn't say it was not. But there are other things further up in the priority list of things that make or break a relationship. We put an awful lot of emphasis on the sexual angle. But when marriages break up or other kinds of breaks happen, that may not be the main cause. So it fits your questioning of the ultimate intimacy or vulnerability.
Along with that, Keith, for me, we as sinful creatures are not responsible enough to draw the line. That's my opinion. And so God has laid down the law, and that is no sex outside of marriage. There shouldn't be any question, but there obviously is. That's why we're here.
To draw which line, you mean, Scott?
I mean, it's as simple as that. Adultery is sexual relations outside of marriage. And he says, no adultery. And we've twisted that. Our society's obviously tried to get around that. And I think, you know, we're just trying to make excuses for ourselves. And it's just so, it's ludicrous for me to even discuss it, but I'll shut up.
I agree with the adultery, because I thought that meant no sex when you're married.
I believe that. Because Jim and I talked about this before, and I forgot to look it up.
The thing I felt about the teaching of sex before marriage, the whole teaching of sex in the Bible, was that we can hung up on the letter of the law rather than the spirit of it. And since we're now considered, well, certainly as Catholics after Vatican II, we're considered more adult in our relationship with God, we're told that we haven't necessarily got to give up meat and eat fish on Friday and say nine levinas and we're guaranteed a place in heaven. We're being told to be responsible in our relationship with other people and with God. And I think that maybe it's time we took the same attitude towards our sexual relations too, and stopped hiding behind laws which might not necessarily be relevant anymore. And I can't explain it any better than that, but I just think that it's time that we were adults in all aspects of our beings, and not just the few that we consider nice and above board and easy. I think it's a challenge to us now that we should try and accept and mumble.
I agree with that, Jim, and I guess that's why I chafe a little bit when people who are not married tell me who am that there's a different set of laws that I have to operate by than people who are not married.
That kind of statement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That bothers me a lot.
I don't understand the different set of laws. Just could you explain what you mean?
Well, I think Jim is trying to maintain that maybe you should articulate this, that maybe before marriage, having sexual relationships is more okay than after you're married. Isn't that what you were saying?
What do you mean? With other, it's okay
outside
of marriage.
It's okay before you're married, but it's not okay after you're married.
That's what she's saying.
It's okay to have maybe, you know, to have a relationship with someone and then with someone else and perhaps with someone else. Then you get married, and at that point, you can't be having any other someone else's. You've decided.
Yeah, that means that I haven't built the marriage.
Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I mean, she's talking about responsible relationships, and I would think that some married couples could have a responsible relationship where the sexual matter was far enough down the totem pole of their priorities that maybe a relationship outside of marriage would be okay and not harm the one they're in. I mean, at least we've got a culture that's trying to maintain that anyway.
Yeah, well, are you saying that you think that's the way it should be?
No, I'm saying that I resent a different set of norms for people outside of marriage than inside. That maybe
I don't know if Gemma would be saying that. She might.
Yeah.
She might be saying that only one at a time. You know, and that would be the same thing as marriage.
Yeah.
Should I say what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I haven't thought through the position of married people, but from my position tonight, I would have thought that marriage commitment meant that you only have sexual relations with your husband.
But if you say that it's okay to have sex outside, you know, before you're married, then it would be okay to be intimate sexually with maybe three people on three different nights of the week.
No.
Okay, because I don't see that much difference even in what Jen is saying, if she's saying that it's only one person at a time.
Yeah, she is talking about a responsible.
Yeah, so there isn't, I don't think that really leaves married people out because you're in your relationship forever. And another, you could just say that someone who isn't married then would be in one relationship and then they'd be in another one maybe in 5 years. And
in effect, what that does is no one finally will get married.
Mm-hmm.
There will be no marriage.
Oh,
I mean, there's no household. There's already no household. There's no, I mean, as you said, the role of women now has changed. The idea of two people who help each other is dissolving. I mean, as women say, we want to be able to support ourselves, which for good reasons, I'm not arguing against it. The idea of household has changed. To support yourself, you don't need anybody to help you anymore. And to have a large family is very much frowned on. So the reasons for being married simply dissolve in front of us. And people will just have serial, you know, we'll just have one relationship after another, and why not?
I think saying what Gemma says does not necessarily preclude what you said. I don't think that's necessarily so. I can't say because the world doesn't entirely operate like that. But I mean, you're saying if what Gemma says is true, then we will not have families and marriage. Well, I don't agree with that.
Well, I don't know if Jen is saying that exactly, but that's not what she's saying.
I said, if what Jen says is true, that's what
it is. Let's just say, if it's possible and all right and perfectly okay to have one relationship after another, each one saying this has integrity, this has meaning, this is loving, and then finally, but if somebody gets married, then that process stops. You've made your mind up now for the rest of your life. Who in the world will get married? Because what reasons are there to get married? And particularly if a marriage can be gotten out of very easily. It seemed to me that Dan, when he said, you know, two people relating to each other in marriage, then are more free because the commitment has been made and no longer is there the fear that if I show this, if I do this, if I reveal myself or if I become vulnerable in this way, my partner may leave me. The promise has been made, and the freedom to be completely open and completely vulnerable now has been given. That was never there before until the marriage happened. But if marriage becomes an impossibility for us simply because we no longer allow for that possibility, if divorce is simply so preeminent a possibility that marriage is thought to be utterly impossible, then that value, that very great value of being of having a promise of intimacy with another person will be, seriously
threatened. Yeah.
Well, I think something Laurie said a while ago makes a lot of sense, and that was that, are we speaking as Christians or as everybody? And I think if you marry as a Christian, then you're also calling on God to give, well, as a sacrament. And it's special. And I don't think that a Christian would enter into marriage perhaps as, not lightheartedly, but I think that they have another dimension which perhaps a non-Christian wouldn't recognize. And I think that it's still a very valuable thing to marry. But I'm just saying that I don't think that single people have to be celibate.
Well, what do you consider celibate?
Not having sexual relations with another person.
Relations or intercourse?
Okay. Yeah, relations. I don't believe in leaping in and out of bed with people, but I do think that if you care for somebody, then I think that should be, because I don't think sex should be blown up. As you said, I don't think it's the most intimate part. It seems to me that it can be another stage of a relationship with someone, which doesn't have to end in marriage.
What would, under this line of argument, what would be an argument against having two wives or two husbands if one felt an equal and total kind of sense of intimacy and commitment and fulfillment and nurturing of all parties?
Do you know anyone who could do that?
Mm-hmm. I have friends who tried. I know of only one. Personally, I know. I mean, where I knew them all well.
I read it in McCall's magazine. Where was happily happy like that. But the daughter who wrote the article said that she wouldn't want to do that.
See, this was the argument that we heard this morning about the Ten Commandments. Was that it's really the message from centuries of experience that it just doesn't work, and that this is the way God graces us with some wisdom about the fact that this thing doesn't work. Whether one can create an argument for or against it is irrelevant. It doesn't work, and therefore don't do it. Is that right, Jim?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's if Scott comes up with the clear announcement that adultery
is. He will probably be shocked by celibate also. It simply means not married.
Yeah. Oh, sorry, okay.
The priests who promise to be celibate promise not to be married. That's my understanding.
I have, someone told me, is this wrong? That priests, they did take a vow of celibacy and it wasn't bad or, you know, considered that wrong if they had relations with sexual intercourse with women.
All I'm saying is technically, or almost a dictionary definition, meant unmarried. It didn't mean that you never had any sexual activity. I think it would be very helpful also in the evening to say intercourse when you mean that. Mm-hmm. I have sexual relations, I hope, with almost everybody I know because they're sexual beings. I have a sexual relationship with my mother and my father. And I do. I mean, I think that's part of our problem. We In our culture right now, there's a tremendous hang-up on intercourse, and sex equals intercourse. My sexuality is much wider than sexual intercourse that I engage in. I think it would be very helpful to use that more technically, not to be picky, but to really help you say what you mean.
In the discussion before Vespers, talked about how to make ethical decisions, and if your decisions were based on is what I do going to bring the other person closer to Christ? If it was that, well, what in the world would you ever need to have sex outside of marriage for? I mean,
intercourse, you mean?
Yeah, intercourse. Yeah, intercourse outside of marriage. What do you need it for?
In the same way that you need any kind of friendship. It's a way of expression.
So it's a choice of if that's what you want to express to a person.
Yeah.
I was thinking before that there are varying degrees of how much you want to express to a person.
Mm-hmm.
So
I can see what Laurie's saying. We had this discussion. I've been talking about these things. We had this discussion over dinner one night, and we just came to.
Well,
Laurie said that if you love someone, then agree to wait. And I said, if you love someone, go ahead. And we came to a deadlock in
that respect. What do you mean by loving someone?
If you care for them, if they're your friend or whatever.
It wasn't that simple. It was simply like, if I said, if sex can really help a marriage bond,
yeah,
then would it be taken away from it,
yeah,
to have intercourse before you're married? Would you be taking away from that bond if you get married someday? And then, if you aren't going to get married someday, maybe the person you're going to have intercourse with is. So aren't you taking away from their bond if, you know, if that first premise was true, with the, whoever they marry? But that's an if at the very beginning, which someone could maybe answer.
I believe that's one of the classical arguments, that to be having intercourse with a person does form or lead to the formation of bonds or bonding between those two people, which does not end if those two people simply decide to go their separate ways. I can testify concerning members of my family that although a marriage has ended in divorce, the relationship between those two people has not ended. And that relationship continues to affect all of us in the family in various and sundry ways. And by relationship, I mean a relationship of bitterness, of resentment, of anger, hatred, or whatever. Unfortunately, the two people who have decided to be divorced are still in some proximity to each other, so that the opportunities for expressing that are present. And it causes a good deal of confusion and some problems. I don't know what effect it has directly on their marriage, because I don't feel free to discuss that, really, with either of them. I mean, the two people now who are married to each other, I mean, I'm not free to talk to them about that. All I know is, looking at it from the outside, I'm very uneasy about it.
I think the points that Laurie and Keith have brought up are important ones, because it has to do with the long-range implications or effect of intercourse between people. What do most of you think about the risk, that is, of how it will affect each individual, say, who may be in a marriage 10 years later, feelings of guilt or remorse or anger toward the other, or lack of trust, you know, when there has been sexual intercourse before marriage, or the effects on other people outside the relationship? Do you think that there is enough, the risk of bad implications is so great that one should abstain from sexual intercourse before marriage? Or do you really think that the experience is mainly just a matter between the two persons, and that the risk of later implications is so minimal that it's worth going ahead?
Can I say one thing? I didn't mean bad implications as far as resentment and bitterness. I mean, is there something so special about the act of sexual intercourse that it is a stronger bond between two people if they've never had it with anybody else before they're married? I'm saying, is that act a strengthening bond, so much so that it would take away from another person's marriage?
I take it that you think that that might be possible.
Well, that's what I'm questioning.
Yeah.
How much reliance would we have on that one act of sexual intercourse in a relationship that it would not... the relationship would not be strong enough in other ways that it could withstand.
Oh,
and not necessarily,
yeah.
I didn't mean to say just withstand, but I mean, there, it is not, we make such a big deal about, I mean, it is important, it's a sacred thing,
mm-hmm.
but we make such a big deal about sexual intercourse and having that be almost the pinnacle to a relationship in marriage. And I just sense that it's one form of expression
mm-hmm.
within that marriage, and
oh,
that the
too.
Sacred of it would not be taken away. I just think that it's given too much emphasis, and it's
mm-hmm.
amongst other things that two people would share.
I think that's true too. And so I don't think that you can have a better marriage even because
mm-hmm.
you hadn't had sex outside of marriage. I'm just saying, you know, would it strengthen it in some way? And not saying your marriage would fail, hadn't had sex outside of marriage at all.
It's a personal question, too.
I don't think it matters anymore.
I was going to point out the double standard that so often I think we've expected the man not to be a virgin upon his marriage, and the woman still even, I think, is assumed the woman is more likely to be a virgin in a marriage than the man. And we don't assume that it's going to weaken the marriage that the man has had intercourse with another woman. But now suddenly we're saying that if the woman has, maybe it will. I'm just bringing out another. Something I've noticed.
Yeah, and my question is, if a couple marries, either knowing that one or both of them have had sexual intercourse beforehand, or discover that later on, is that a threat to their sense of trust and commitment and intimacy? Can that have a ruinous effect or a damaging effect on a marriage, knowing that this person had sexual intercourse with somebody else before and now with me, and what would there be to keep the person from engaging in it right now or next week with somebody else? Can it affect the marriage in a disastrous way?
I think it could, but that depends so much on the individuals and how different people look at things. I don't know. I had a minister friend of mine tell me, just because you don't feel guilty doesn't mean you aren't. And I, you know, I didn't agree with that. I don't see an answer for your question once that answered.
I don't think that's so totally bizarre. Does everyone think it's bizarre?
What? Just no. Because you don't feel guilty doesn't mean you aren't. Don't we ask
to give it your sins not aware?
Yeah. No, I don't. I don't know how to explain it right now, but yeah, I don't think it's off the wall. What are other people's ideas in response to David's question?
I don't know, I just feel that if two people are going to get married, and that's something that they should discuss before they're married. And after that, if it doesn't bother either one of them, and they say, okay, we know what, you know, promise to be faithful or whatever, and go into the marriage that way, that's one thing. Mm-hmm. So I think a lot harder after you're married or whatever to have those things come out or whatever, and then there'd be a lot more question, why did you tell me before we got married or whatever?
Ann Lander suggests you do not tell.
She
may ruin something if you tell, but
what happens after you're married?
Ruin it by telling, and it's not the word safe in the beginning.
That was a very good exchange right there. There were lights flashing all over the place on that one.
And Ann Landers isn't always right.
Oh, I don't know.
One thing I've noticed in people, well, do you think this is true? In my experience, when I'm with people that, well, okay, up in Alaska or working at a restaurant, it's just an accepted norm among everybody who's not a Christian. It seems to me, you know, that sure, it's fine if you date someone you kind of like and go to bed with them, of course. No big deal at all. And so that's kind of what I react against too. I find myself getting sucked into that. And without questioning the rightness and wrongness of that kind of attitude. And I think that really prevails among people around our ages.
Yeah, and it's at that point I start thinking, my goodness, am I ever naive, you know, still theologizing about sexual intercourse. I don't know. are we totally out of touch with her, or do we still have something really to say from our family, our tradition, our Bible?
Can I bring up something, Dan? I wanted to ask you before, and I think I say it to now, and that really spoke to me, and I didn't react to it. In your little diagram here, whatever. One of the little dead ends that we might fall into is not situational ethics of do what you feel. And you were saying how this can encompass anything from selfish hedonism to enlightened hedonism. And I thought, yes, that's true. And when do you really know who judges whether or not you're being enlightenedly hedonistic or whether or not you're trying to love that person as truthfully as you can? And that's a very thin borderline, I think, which for anyone of us who wants to take the path of believing that you can have sexual intercourse outside marriage, it's demanding a very high degree of honesty from you, that you balance this line between enlightened hedonism and love. And I hadn't thought of it until tonight, and I was, as Peter pointed it out, and I wondered if anyone else had seen it in that light.
You're saying that outside of marriage is more of a chance of getting into enlightened hedonism?
Yeah. No, that's a good point. Maybe within too.
Yeah. It seemed like it would be just as, I don't know. Just as easy.
Because the concern I have is how can we start discussing the issue from the point of view of loving relationship over against exploitive relationships, both inside marriage and outside marriage, how do we do that and still without denying the importance of what we call the covenant of commitment. There's a danger in assuming once you're married, exploitation is fine.
Yeah.
And it's almost a license to...
That's some of what I'm having trouble with, even in this discussion, and I don't know how to articulate it exactly. The fact that people who are not married seem to put this sacrosanct holy of holies around it, when I see so much exploitation and abuse, and I'm cynical going to weddings now, because I've watched my friends, whom I care about a lot, breaking their marriages up, and I heard them say those vows 14 years ago, where they meant them every bit as much as the ones I hear now. And I have a hard time keeping my cynicism at bay. I do what you do, Lori, I guess, where I feel myself sucked into this attitude about marriage that I don't want. I'd like to keep it sacrosanct too. But I feel moved toward an attitude where, I don't know.
I've had a lot of friends say, Mama, I don't know if I really want to get married. Here is so-and-so and so-and-so. They are such strong Christians. And, and 3 years later, now they're divorced. I thought any marriage was going to work very well.
And that after the divorce, some of them are still good Christians. I mean, divorcing doesn't make them not good Christians.
By a good Christian.
Well, that's always hard to define. It varies with individuals, but there's still people who care about their personal relationship to their Christ. They go to church and feel themselves Christians. But their marriage broke up.
No, Karen, remember when we read or shared about that Wendell Berry's talking about the household and how the sexual relationship of two people, and I mean that and not intercourse now, but the whole sexual relationship, even that is not sufficient or total to the marriage, to a marriage. Or at least there was a time when it was not. When there was a household, when two people who were married together were also had many other things that they were doing together, there were other qualities to the relationship which perhaps do not exist now.
Mutually determined.
Yes. Now two people come from two different directions to the same house.
And go to
and then go out from there again. Mm-hmm. And that, when you talk about changing social conditions, that really, we're not, none of us can lift ourselves out of that. And I thought when Dan said whether, are we just, are we just off here, said we're on our own and they've lost touch? I thought of Paul saying, if we Christians have hope only for this life, we are of all people most to be pitied, is a possible reflection on that. If the only thing, that we've got to talk about is is this life, whatever Paul may mean by that, something about this temporality, this here and now, or this world or something, boy, then we're crazy. Why should we deny ourselves anything? Why not grab everything within sight? Or why not free ourselves from some archaic system and say, oh, everything's up for grabs and I've got to go read all the current psychologies and do it. May lead to something that's quite admirable, as well as fun. Perhaps there's something beyond happiness or fulfillment. Perhaps being a fool for Christ is to really be a fool in the eyes of the world and sometimes in our own eyes.
Well, it sounds like in this culture, the burden falls on those who think there shouldn't be sexual intercourse before marriage to try to make a case for that position, because there are so many who, in our culture, who see that that's not a problem. And one position for the Christian who proposes sexual intercourse before marriage would be simply that it's one of the commandments. There are biblical commands against it. Are there other arguments that the Christian has to use to try to convince people that there shouldn't be sexual intercourse before marriage?
Well, this is the traditional old-fashioned sort of argument, and in the day of the pill and it's probably really almost not a big issue, except that right now in my life, there's a very close situation to me of a life that is going to come into the world as a result of the sexual intercourse before marriage. And as Keith said a lot way back at the beginning of this discussion, what we do does not only affect us, me and the other person. There's a ripple that goes on. It affects relationships. And one of the most vital things it affects is maybe a new life that might, as because of a mistake or because of some other thing, be affected.
Well, there are
there's going to be a baby that is not going to have a home relationship with a mother and a father. I mean, I have friends that are in this situation. Now, granted, there are many home situations that have babies that have horrible, mothers and fathers. So it's really kind of hard to say. And yet, I think you do have to realize that what you do is going to have an effect on other people, and not just yourself.
I think people should also realize that there is no safe birth control method. Mm-hmm. There is none.
Except abstinence.
It's true, but if it's a burden you put on the woman for that. People should know that whatever method she's using may not be safe for her.
So just to make the argument a little bit neater, what if we assume that, say, both unmarried parties have been surgically rendered impotent, vasectomy, or tying the tubes, which is a relatively safe method of birth control, so that the question of childbirth is removed. Does that change it at all? We can be pretty sure that they were not going to be any children.
Is it interesting thing? Well, it's bound to change something. I'm not sure I'm not saying that the possibility of children is the only argument I have against it.
So I'm wondering what
one of the
I was not going to base a comment on that. So if that doesn't mean that's not a legitimate path to pursue. I think I kind of enjoy being unique after a while, especially in Washington, D.C., and in a sophisticated culture of thinking that there was great fulfillment in that which now is old-fashioned. Yes, I'm not at all apologetic. I was a virgin when I got married, and I've always been faithful to Mary in regard to not having intercourse with anybody else. I don't think I've been deprived by that. I think some of the arguments, I'm glad also that we are married, meaning that those days when the relationship is not what it could be, you can't easily walk away from it because the greatest joys have come in kind of that being some reconciliation and some cycles. We're married 25 years now. We have more fun sexually than we did when we first got married. I think intimacy comes after the 20th anniversary, and you can't, you certainly can't do that on one night date. I don't think it's ever very satisfactory in the back of a car. I think you get a bad back. I think you get a less than God-given joy when you're both scared that you might get caught, or I think it's kind of fun to be old-fashioned, because if Dan wants an argument, that one of the things now is with all of the changes, with that being old-fashioned, we have fewer people talking about being fulfilled. And we know more about intercourse, and we have more dirty jokes and know less about love and less about deep joy than in some old-fashioned period. So I think there's lots of things you can say. That doesn't mean that I don't think there were and are some. The Puritans get blamed for it. It really isn't puritanical. There are, I don't know, what should it be? It's not the Puritans who had to hang up on sex, or somebody else, but the Puritans get blamed. That there were some Greek ideas, if we're still talking Greek and Hebrew after I've been gone 3 days, that we've not been, that there have been some repressive ideas by the church, and I'm glad they're gone. In other words, the good old days, some people stayed together because the social pressures were such that you couldn't leave without it being horrendous, and I'm not sure that was freeing. And I think the major thing I'm delighted about is there were some almost master-slave relationships with male domination. Our kids still laugh. There's one home we went to in West Virginia where we all sat in the kitchen because we were the guests, and the wife was, or we sat around the table and the wife was in another room, and when the man wanted more food, he pounded on the wall and she brought it in. That still takes place some places. Intimacy, including intercourse, seems to me that grows in the joys and sorrows and pains and shared raising of kids or not, but over a long period of time. The richness of that relationship comes in a long-term commitment. And I think there's some things you can say about that. I almost got sentimental there. The one about the bad back, that's really a good argument.
But Jeff's not talking about running around and doing it in the back of a car. She's talking about having a significant relationship with someone.
Paul says somewhere that says, do you not know that when you join with a prostitute, you are internally joined or something? And then C.S. Lewis, we use that in Screwtape Letters somewhere, says something to the effect that when you have intercourse, then you are joined together eternally or something. That always kind of makes me think, oh my goodness, you know, because what does that mean for people to have had many different partners? Are they going to have six people that they're joined eternally with or something. I mean, that's, I'm kind of facetious, but still that's something to think about. I don't know exactly what was meant there.
The question would be, Kay or Jim, the question would be, is there something about intercourse itself beyond other forms of sexuality, of hugs, of forms of intimacy? Is there something about intercourse itself which means that it should be reserved for that long-term relationship? And that's the question of the forum tonight. And there are different ideas from that. I think there are even some arguments or points that you could make on, in Laurie's terms, is that intimacy in sexual intercourse a kind of binding thing for the marriage? I think it is, at least at the beginning. I think that's one of the things that is, that the freedom in a society that accepts some prohibitions against intercourse outside of marriage, and our society still does, at least some places, the freedom for that, to fully experience that, is part of the honeymoon, the glow, the what have you. I think when that's exclusively with that one person, then there are no comparisons, there are no questions, all of which, we are sexual people, all of which either enhance that vulnerability or complete abandonment, or always bring some kind of hesitation, mental or otherwise, to that. I think there can even be some statements made in the possible enrichment of that being an exclusive relationship, or having it only in that intimacy of marriage. Yes, I don't know who
that's,
I'm answering.
That's good. But then I've had people say to me, but don't you always wonder then, is it, you know, wouldn't it be better with someone else? And so if you have several different experiences, then you can decide, well, no, it wouldn't be that much better, and so I'm satisfied with who I have. You know? I've heard that kind of argument.
Well, that's not quite as bad as it used to be. It used to be all male. You wouldn't buy a pair of shoes till you tried it on or something. I mean, it used to be crass. Yours is a little better. I guess my point is, I think that makes too much of intercourse and doesn't understand relationship. It isn't so much, is this married partner as good in bed as some other woman might be for me? It's that there is a relationship in which I experience this fullness. It includes intercourse, and ours has included children. But I don't try to compare Mary with other women. I'm in a relationship, a marriage.
It's an irrelevant question.
And so the question is, I really think our age is more hung up on intercourse than it need be. It talks about freedom, but I think it's a hang up and not a freedom. I guess if you were debating, that could sound like a kind of put down so that you can't argue back. I don't mean it that way. I don't mean that now when we continue to talk about it, we prove my point that it's a hang up. I didn't mean that we shouldn't have a forum on it. But I really don't think we're as free as our age likes to think we are. And the worst indications of not being free are something like Playboy, or something which is the worst of our understanding of sexuality, especially, the woman is a play thing or some such thing, isn't it? I mean, it's just
playmate.
There, I think you have a further indication of the not understanding us as sexual beings by creation, but a very limited, maybe that's what I mean, we have a very limited understanding of sex and of sexuality, rather than a full understanding.
I think, John, I'm still old-fashioned enough to think that your kind of marriage in our culture seems ideal, that you have a one-to-one relationship and you're faithful within that. But I think that by, take the example of before one is married, I think that by truncating a certain part of your activity with a partner is making it an issue of it and saying we'll go thus far and no further. It's to magnify the no further because you've made an issue of it. I'm just suggesting that maybe if we're really going to be fully human and fully sexual beings, that this doesn't need to be the case. And yes, it calls for responsibility and it calls for total honesty, but I don't think that it's going to be a sin against God if that takes place, if sexual intercourse takes place before marriage. I mean, you've said this before in different ways, but I still think yours is an ideal. Like in a friendship, you're going out with someone and you know it's not perfect, and you're waiting for maybe the right person to turn up, but you still grow and learn through that friendship. You don't, as soon as you realize that a friendship with one person isn't going to be ideal and forever, you don't stop that friendship. You still enjoy the company of that person. I think the same can be with the sexual relationship too, sexual intercourse too. Even if you're not going to marry that person, if that's the way you're expressing yourself with them right now, then I don't see that as being wrong.
To take that position is to assume an ideal strength within yourself and within the person that you may marry. The question of whether or not you're open before you're married still doesn't preclude the possibility of that coming up later when one or the other of you is angry, you know, or it doesn't preclude the possibility of a formation of an attachment that you're not altogether able to expunge from yourself and be free of. It assumes a sort of an ideal or total amount of control. In other words, before the fact, you say, I will do this, and later on, I'll still be free. And I think some of the things that people have said tonight have indicated that that may not be the case. You may not be free because you've got a child. It's one possibility. You may not be free because later on, comparisons come up in your brain, even if you don't want them to. Mm-hmm. You may hate the idea that you're comparing, but you may still do it. Or what else?
Yeah.
I mean, all sorts of things.
Sure, I see that, but life is a risk. I mean, we're either going to be Zorba the Greek or we're going to be jailed for the proof rock. I think I'd rather be Zorba the Greek.
No, there's all sorts of other choices, all sorts of other possibilities. It's not an either or.
I hear what you're saying, and I, my comments were not to put you down. I think you also can have the assumption that it will be a relationship that does not include intercourse and be just as free from it,
mm-hmm.
and not feel truncated.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And certainly the trend, as far as all the surveys and all the attitudes, and on our vacation, I watched teenagers in Washington, D.C. talking about the social life in D.C. high schools, is more in line with what you're saying than what I'm saying. More people would feel that they were stopping short of fully expressing themselves than in my day, and certainly in a former day.
Yeah, it's the thing of your time and your culture.
I haven't thought this through all the way, but my response is to disagree with John's statement that we maybe make too much of sexual intercourse, if I understood him. I think that the problem might be the opposite, that is that we tend to make too little of it. That is to think that, well, it's insignificant, really. You know, if we're kissing heavily, you know, what's sexual intercourse, but a little bit more intense. But what we discover is when people are married and discover that one member of the couple is having sexual intercourse with somebody else, how about how that affects individuals. You know, it's crushing to discover, I think in the case of most married couples, to discover that somebody else, that your spouse is having sexual intercourse with somebody else. And it's such a demeaning thing to the other spouse, I think in most cases. There's such a loss of trust that occurs, another kind of vulnerability that has opened up in the relationship, that it's a sign that the effects of engaging in sexual intercourse are immense on people who do it. and to treat it lightly as something either before marriage or in an adulterous situation as something light and unimportant, I think is a mistake. I've seen so many lives that have been badly damaged because sexual intercourse doesn't matter so much.
Also, David, when you said earlier about how we are going to present a view to others, if there's a position and I have to persuade others, and when you said that, I was thinking that really a good deal of my interest in this is as help for myself. I want the marriages around me to be stable so that I can relate with a married woman without feeling that I'm going to get entangled in this, in something, you know, that where sexual intercourse is a possibility. I don't want that to be there. And I don't need to be pushed down the path where that becomes more likely rather than less likely, for example. Similarly, if an ethic is developed in a society where it becomes quite likely that people will have sexual intercourse, I think there may be strong people, responsible people, who can survive it very handily. And that's my language. Someone else's language may be even more complimentary. It may be a real plus. It might be a real good thing, you know. But I think then there are others around who get pushed in directions that perhaps they would rather not go. But it's an all right thing. If everyone's smoking grass and I'm somewhat tempted to smoke it, maybe I will. If everyone's having intercourse, I've got reservations, but somehow I'm not sure if I'm okay if I'm not. I think when Paul says, you know, it's all right for me to eat meat, but if by doing it I cause someone to fall because that meat was consecrated to an idol, then I won't do it. Our responsibility extends beyond ourselves. And that's a heavy one. It's a heavy one. And I can't honestly say that I watch myself all the time concerning that. I couldn't even. How would I possibly judge every act I did in the light of what kind of an effect that might have? I'd be immobilized. But one thing I can do is trust my church and trust the people of the fellowship who are saving me from having to examine every last act by saying, here are some things, you know, stay within this and you're in the area. There is a certain kind of a guide that's set up that saves me. And in the meantime, maybe this is the area now that's proper to investigate. Could be. Vegetarianism or not is not perhaps such a big thing, and maybe we're free from fighting over that too much so that we can discuss this now. Maybe this is what we're supposed to be talking about. I don't know.
What Scott was going to bring us, what it is. What's the commandment?
Yeah. Okay. Well, I was wrong in limiting it to adultery, because adultery is intercourse outside of marriage by a spouse or whatever. But what?
By a spouse?
Well, okay, let me read it to you. I'm not talking right. I sat in back here because I was embarrassed to bring these huge books here. Okay. Okay, adultery is voluntary sexual intercourse between a married person and one not the lawful spouse, etc. And then, okay, somewhere in the New Testament, I don't know what the exact book or verse, but it mentions that fornication is also out of the question. And I read that. Human sexual intercourse, other than between a man and his wife, sexual intercourse between a spouse and an unmarried person, that takes in adultery. Sexual intercourse between unmarried people. So.
Did you look up collating?
But, what?
Paul talking about fornication.
Yeah, I know.
Fornicators.
I know. I've always read that in Genesis, and then the other night, and I go, oh. Well, often, which sometimes, yeah, sometimes the Bible is right in saying it mentions fornication as that being sexual relations between, sexual intercourse between two single people. But also, I was trying to put that in context of when it was written, when, in fact, that might have meant adultery, because if everyone was betrothed to someone at a very young age, or else married very young, there were no single people. So in a way, that negates that, and that also means adultery. And I still think, I'm not with Karen yet about adultery, I think that one through, but I can still see that if you've made a marriage commitment, then it probably isn't so wise to break the trust. But so far, I can see your point, Scott, and I checked all those verses too. And I'm sure sometimes if we're going to follow the letter of the law, then maybe the Bible says that following every single letter that, yeah, okay, sexual relations, sexual intercourse between two single people is not ideal. But then we've glossed over so much else that the Bible also said literally. There was a whole bit about women which it takes literally.
Yeah, the Bible's
basically
against women.
Yeah, against women, and it's against another thing that I looked up. I just, Scott missed that, but I was saying that we should go more by the spirit of the Bible rather than the letter of the law.
Well, my question still is, where do you draw the line? You've got to draw the line somewhere. And the society has not. It's evaded it and made excuses for itself and said, well, why not go a step further? And, well, why not go a step further than that? It just keeps mushrooming and snowballing. And for me anyway, maybe I'm a simpleton, but I've got to have a law. And it's got to be spelled out. And yeah, I agree with taking things into context too, but as far as this goes.
It seems to me that one question that keeps kind of popping up in my mind whenever anybody says something is, we don't really understand the ramifications or the effects of sexual intercourse, either at the time or later. I mean, it seems to me that as a child, I don't think we're taught or we don't understand, you know, what really is meant by intimacy, or what really is meant, or what does that act of sexual intercourse actually mean? Not just now, but in 10 years or 15, 20 years from now, what is that going to happen? What's that going to do? Or how will that affect me? How will that affect the people I deal with? That keeps popping up when there people are saying, gee, we don't really understand, you know, all those ramifications. And how can we understand it?
I appreciated the thing Jim said this morning in talking about the last several commandments as being guides to allowing us to live in community. That is, to not steal and not covet a neighbor's wife and so forth. That we'd all be in an entirely different communal relationship here if we had to lock our doors and worry about not leaving things around for fear they'd be stolen. Or if those of us who are married would have to worry that maybe our spouse was having sexual intercourse with somebody else in the community, which might be a real threat if it were obvious that even those who weren't married were engaging constantly in sexual intercourse, and that, you know, it clearly wasn't reserved for a marriage relationship in the eyes of the unmarried people here, that would pose more of a threat, I think, even to those who are married. And I think you know, it might work the other way around, too, that if married couples didn't keep sexual intercourse just between themselves, but saw no problem in engaging in it with others, that it would be a threat to everyone else.
You see, one is leading to the other. Is that what you're saying?
I think that if we lived in a society where nobody had sexual intercourse except in marriage, I certainly wouldn't worry that Karen was having sexual intercourse with one whereas if the community had an entirely different attitude about it, why, I might be threatened and worried about it. And that would be damaging to our relationship. Just the worry, the worry of it would.
Well, you know, when you know that it's a possibility, I mean, it happens all the time in the world anyway, why don't you still worry?
I want to pick up on Peter's comment up here. Excuse me, do you want to?
Well, I just trust care.
But you wouldn't if there was open sex between people that weren't married up here.
I'd,
if that's the norm in the community.
Yeah, I think I'd worry about living in a community where the prevailing norm were something different.
That's the society we're in. Yeah. I mean, that's the larger society.
You're under attack. You'd be under attack even though you weren't, even though you maybe weren't afraid that someone was going to come into your house or something while you're gone, but your ideas of who you were would still be under attack.
Yeah. But it is true that the larger society is more like that, and I ought to be more worried than I am.
I want to pick up on Peter's comment about long-range implications and things. We attended a 65th wedding anniversary this end of the summer back in Michigan, and a part of it was a tremendous event, and there was a lot of joy as we saw one part of the family through the generations holding together and strong and supportive and loving and happy, and everything works somehow. And another part of the family where things don't work, and the reason things are not working in the other part of the family, by not working I mean the school isn't going well and there's trouble with the law and there's all sorts of problems all over the place. And it seems like things are not working. Well, they're not working, I believe, because the families have been broken apart. And so we all got back together, and it was extremely unpleasant. One dimension of that reunion was very unpleasant. And it really centered around the fracturing of family. And I think the wisdom of the ages that comes from the Ten Commandments is greater than our present cultural situation. The wisdom of the ages is, it seems to me, that what God intends is for us to be, if we choose to be married, His intention is for us to be married 50 years and 60 and more. And within that shelter of a long-term relationship, there is growth and there's health and there's stability and there's a blossoming that happens. And there's all sorts of ways in which you can say, well, I can still be healthy and happy and whole even if my folks are divorced, and even if I'm divorced, certainly that's true. But I guess what I'm pleading for is more of a long-range vision of things, to say that we are not all that smart, but maybe the commandments have more wisdom than our short-range vision of things.
Emma, you believe that what John talked about is in as a marriage is better, you said, as an ideal.
Yeah, I still go back to that.
Well, if it is better, well, why shouldn't we want the best, too? That's a question I have. If it is better, why not have the best?
You can have both.
But why'd you say that's better? It's more ideal to have no sex. It's the ideal.
No, I don't mean the bit about being a virgin when you're married. I meant about the idea of having a virtual marriage.
Okay. Yeah.